Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Totally Football Show. I'm here in the headquarters of The Athletic with Tom Williams. Welcome aboard, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
Not at all. The pleasure is all mine because nearly 20 years ago, as a young journalist, desperately trying to fill the gaps in my knowledge, I had lots of good places to go. I had Phil Ball's Morbo for Spain. I had John Foote's Calcio for Italy. I had Uli Hess's Tor, a masterpiece.
Of course.
For Germany. There was nothing for France. Nothing. Until now.
Now there is.
Because Vavavoom. Tom, tell me about the book.
So yeah, Vavavoom, The Modern History of French Football, does pretty much what it says on the tin, in that it recounts the last sort of 40, 45 years in the history of French football. So on the one hand, the evolution of the French national team and the French style of play, as much as such a thing exists, and also the exploits of all the great teams, the great players of this modern era. And the reason that I've written it is, you know, precisely because there was, you know, the gap in the market that you've just alluded to. I always found it peculiar that a book like this didn't already exist. And I get that there has not traditionally in this country been an enormous appetite for material about French football. But nevertheless, there are so many incredible stories in French football. And, you know, French football has had such an influence on the game in Europe, on the game around the world. You think about, you know, the French players, even just in the Premier League, who have, you know, radically transformed English football. And that's all in there as well. So, yeah, basically the idea with this book is that you, if you have any curiosity about French football whatsoever, if you want to learn a bit more about, you know, where it's come from and where it is today and where it might be going, and you also want to read about the impact that French players and French coaches had around Europe, this is the book for you, and it will neatly plug that gap in your bookshelf.
It's a nice loose read as well. You get some history books which are very almost prescriptive in the way that they tell them, 1961 this happened, in 1962. There's none of that here. It pings about from story to story.
Yeah, I mean, that was very much the idea right from the start. I mean, I think my initial idea when it came to writing a book about French football history was that you'd have to write about the whole thing. You'd have to go back to, you know, the late 19th century and explain how everything came together. And ultimately had a conversation with my literary agent, Melanie, and she suggested that, you know, why don't you just start in the early 80s? Start when it gets exciting, when it gets interesting, when, you know, French football starts to acquire some of the sex appeal that we occasionally associate with it, which is what I've done. And at the same time, I think because you can't necessarily assume that the average football fan is going to have the patience to read reams and reams and reams about French football, I've written it in a way that it kind of, you know, speeds along at a fairly elevated pace, I would say. And I guess that, yeah, that probably ties in a bit with the title as well.
Yeah, it's nice. You can feel the reader will, you know, pick up a bit of Marseille in the 1990s, and then suddenly there's Zidane. It's like, oh, Zidane, there's something I can cling on to. And then it takes you off down another rabbit warren. One person who I've always loved and I was delighted to see so much ink spent on is Guy Roux, or Zaire, who had the kind of longevity that makes Arsene Wenger and Sir Alex Ferguson look like interim managers. Tell us a bit about him and what he did.
Yeah, Guy Roux is kind of stands apart in French football history and European football history, you know, partly by dint of his extraordinary longevity. So he became Auxerre coach in 1961 when he was only 22 years old, transformed them from a run-of-the-mill amateur outfit into one of the best teams in France, and very briefly one of the best teams in Europe. You know, ends up winning League and Cup double, multiple Coupe de France, and basically stays in place, give or take a couple of minor leaves of absence, until 2005. So he was in charge of Auxerre for 44 years, and obviously in this country, when we think about managers who piloted their clubs for long periods of time, we immediately think of Sir Alex Ferguson, we immediately think of Arsene Wenger, and even they now feel like they belong to another age. And you know, Guy Roux was in place at Auxerre for even longer. And the chapter on Auxerre is just an interview with him, because his career spans such a long time, and because the story of Auxerre as a football club is pretty much the story of Guy Roux.
And you've actually gone out there to see him, and he's taken you out for lunch. It's a lovely chapter. He seems to be like the grandfather to everyone in that town.
Yeah, completely. And you know, that was probably one of the most enjoyable days that I had while I was working on the book. Spending an afternoon with Guy Roux, you know, kind of mooching around Auxerre, which is a beautiful town. And it's quite a small town. I think it's got a population of about 35,000 people, which, again, you know, only serves to underline how remarkable it was that he succeeded in turning Auxerre into this, you know, leading light in French football for as long as he did. But it also means that everyone in the town knows him, you know. So everywhere we went, he's, you know, kind of like waving and smiling to people. And we had lunch sitting outside an Italian restaurant. And we were probably there for a couple of hours. I swear about 10 or 12 people came up to interrupt us and speak to him. And some of them just wanted to say hello. Some of them just wanted a selfie. Some of them knew him. There was some guy came over who had some kind of problem with his, some kind of rental dispute, and also seemed to suggest that his life was under threat.
Oh, wow.
I had no idea, like, you know, who he was or what the kind of the basis of this claim was. But he sort of, you know, took the time to kind of talk to him and kind of reassure him and give him some advice. And yeah, he is a very singular figure. And I suspect we probably won't see a managerial career like his ever again.
And he comes across as so affable and avuncular. And one of my favourite bits was the way he was keeping track on his players in the 60s when they were heading out of town for big dances when they shouldn't have been. How was he catching them?
Yeah, so I mean, Guy Roux is renowned above all for being a disciplinarian, and some of the stories about him are ridiculous. And one of the things that he told me about was how, in the 60s, when he was trying to keep tabs on his players, he would check the mileages on the dashboards of their cars to see whether there were any kind of great fluctuations. And he also knew that there was a very popular local orchestra that the players liked to go and see, you know, when they were playing at local dances. And he would calculate the mileage between where the player, you know, where the player lived, where he parked his car, and where the most recent dance was. And then we'd then go back the following morning, and if there was, say, you know, 127 kilometres on the clock, he, you know, quickly made the calculation that was, you know, whatever it is there and back. And so he, you know, he basically caught them. And then that evolved in time, you know, into the 80s and the 90s with players driving up to Paris. And he talks about Gibril Cissé, he's one of the many players who came through the ranks at Auxerre. Gibril Cissé going up to Paris in his Ferrari, you know, hitting the nightclubs, and Guy Roux was basically in league with all the toll booth operators on the motorway, who would all tip him off, you know, as and when an Auxerre player, you know, came past at an hour of the day or night when he should have been, you know, should have been safely tucked up in bed.
Makes Ferguson look like a hands-off boss.
And, it does.
Guy Roux's not the only character. One who I'd vaguely heard of but didn't know enough about, Claude Bez at Bordeaux, who might just be the most French person I've ever seen.
Yeah, he's certainly the most French-looking French person or up there. Claude Bez, who was the chairman of Bordeaux throughout their sort of 1980s glory days, was a local accountant who I think initially joined Bordeaux as a treasurer, then became president, and it's a remarkable looking guy, thick set, enormous thick brown walrus moustache, completely concealing his whole mouth. And he was a very interesting figure because he was extremely ambitious and had lots of very forward-thinking ideas about how to run a football club. He was a key figure in French TV rights negotiations and getting French broadcasters to pay to show French matches in the first place. You know, agreed various pioneering sponsorship deals, but was also, you know, quite a grouchy, irritable, impatient guy, spoke with a stammer, and he kind of ended up locking horns with Bernard Tapie. When Tapie was in charge at Marseille, and for a few years, and this coincides with the early years of the Tapie era at Marseille, when you've got Chris Waddle and Jean-Pierre Papin and Enzo Francescoli and all the rest of them, you've got this kind of team of superstars from the Mediterranean coast, led by Bernard Tapie, who is this extremely charismatic, very successful, good-looking, tanned guy from Paris, actually, going up against Claude Bez, who's kind of like, you know, French football's like ultimate outsider in a way. And yeah, that was a kind of a fascinating duel for a few years, and really spoke to a point at which the French club game started to really kind of take off, where you had these slightly more canny, slightly more business-minded chairman looking to see how they could take French football to the next level.
And what a team Marseille create. I mean, there'll be a lot of people listening to this who won't be aware of this team or aware of the 20 years of French teams getting pretty good and not quite to the very top. But Marseille were just on another level, weren't they?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, this is the heritage of French football. You know, this idea of, you know, France as the ultimate nearly men. And there's this sort of curious sort of dichotomy within French football in that for years, French teams, be it club teams or be it the national team, were kind of there but not quite, you know, getting to major semi-finals, getting to major finals and somehow, you know, fumbling the ball or crashing and burning. And, you know, French clubs had been trying to win the European Cup ever since its creation, and it was, you know, it was a French invention, as so many of the major tournaments that are still played today, you know, were and are. And Bernard Tapie puts a huge amount of money into building this super club in Marseille. You know, not dissimilar to the way that PSG have gone about things in the modern era, albeit with not quite the same level of wealth, and puts this team together that is just kind of, you know, superstars in almost every position. And they reach the European Cup final in 1991, lose on penalties to Red Star Belgrade. But then 2 years later, they get back into the final. They play Milan in Munich, and Basil Boli's header gives them victory and gives France its first and to date only European Cup. And then within months, the entire, you know, Marseille citadel has collapsed because the match fixing allegations have come out.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to that in just a tick. But Chris Waddle, I mean, again, not everyone will realise this, but he was basically Elvis over there. I mean, when I went out to cover Euro 2016, Marseille was my first point of call, and the taxi driver, as soon as he found out I was English, all he wanted to talk about was Chris Waddle. The guy was an absolute legend out there, but it didn't start so well for him.
No, I mean, you know, as is the case with, you know, with lots of players who move to a different country, it took him time to settle. You know, he arrives at the height of a Marseille summer, which for a lad from Gateshead is probably a bit of a shock to the senses. The rest of the squad had already been in pre-season for a while. He was, you know, carrying a few extra kilos, didn't speak the language. He was there with his wife and their baby daughter, living in this grotty hotel in Aix-en-Provence for the first few weeks. And Marseille have broken the bank to sign him. He's the third most expensive player in world football history when he arrives. And you know, initially his performances aren't quite at the level that the club and the extremely demanding Marseille fan base are hoping for. Part of it, Waddle realises, is that he's not being played in the position where he wants to play. He's sort of being asked to play as kind of a number 10, and he wants to be out on the right-hand side, cutting in onto his left foot. And then he scores this incredible goal against PSG at a time when that rivalry, you know, the Le Classique, as we now refer to it these days, in a slightly contrived way, is only just sort of taking root. You've got Tapi at Marseille, who's kind of building up this super club, and there's a desire, a fairly commonly held desire within French football, to build up a similarly spectacular and successful club in Paris. And Waddle scores this incredible goal, chests the ball down, flicks it over Joël Batz, the PSG goalkeeper, backheels it into the net. And then that's it. He's off and running. And I think something that we perhaps don't always realise in this country, you know, he is an absolute superstar in France. And part of that is to do with the footballer he was, you know, an extremely exciting, devil-may-care dribbler, a real crowd pleaser. But also, and I inevitably write about this in the book, but I think the language barrier forced him to lean into this kind of clownish side to his character, which I don't think we really saw all that much when he was playing in England. And I, you know, I spoke to Spurs fans who remember him when he was at Tottenham, and because I wanted to just to check, because my recollection of Waddle as a footballer, I don't remember him being seen as this kind of, you know, clown prince figure, whereas in France they do. And it's almost a kind of a bit of a Paul Gascoigne element to it. This guy who's constantly kind of playing up to the camera, gurning at TV cameras, kind of clowning around on the pitch, you know, signing autographs during breaks in play, pretending to fall asleep with his head on the ball, a free kick, stuff like that. And that kind of, that took him to the next level. And he was a superstar. You had kids with Chris Waddle haircuts, all sorts of merchandise, you know, released with his name on. He records a pop song with Basil Boli, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend you seek out. And yeah, I mean, there's a chapter in the book dedicated to the British and Irish players who went over to France in the late 80s and the early 90s. And he was, yeah, quite comfortably the most successful one.
And such an extraordinary thing to stand out in that team, where you've got Abedi Pelé, who arguably the best player Africa's produced at that point, Jean-Pierre Papin, who... And I don't want to say this and sound mean, but not the most technically brilliant striker, but worked so hard and became Europe's most potent striker. You've got Basil Boli at the back as this absolute warrior. They should be the biggest team in Europe for the next 5 years. They're not. As you said earlier, it all comes falling down very quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, even by the time that they won the Champions League in 1993, the inaugural Champions League, Papin's already gone. So that team is kind of in a bit of a transitional phase. And a lot of Marseille fans will tell you that the teams of 2 or 3 years earlier were much better than that one. But that was the one that had acquired the experience required to get over the line in Europe at long last. But then even before they play that final against Milan, this accusation is made that they've tried to fix their previous league game against Valenciennes. They're on course for the title. Valenciennes are trying to avoid relegation. The allegation is that Marseille's directors paid off Valenciennes players to take it easy because they didn't want their players being crocked for the final. And Bernard Tapie had in mind the 1976 European Cup final when Saint-Étienne lost to Bayern Munich at Hampden Park in Glasgow, which is where the book begins, with a couple of players who'd been nobbled a few days previously in an extremely physical game against Nîmes. And Tapie's account of what happened in the Valenciennes match-fixing affair was that he was just trying to avoid that. He was trying to avoid his players being injured for the final. So they offered a financial inducement to the Valenciennes players to take it easy. And this allegation is made public before the Champions League final. Marseille then go on and win the Champions League, which is this, you know, historic breakthrough moment for French football. And I think the feeling at Marseille is that, oh, well, you know, we've been accused of lots of things, because there were accusations about Tapie and various murky goings-on, shall we say, pretty much throughout his tenure. And Marseille had managed to shrug them all off. And I think a lot of people at Marseille thought, well, here we go. This is the, you know, this is the powers that be in Paris. They don't like the fact that there's this upstart club in the south of France in, you know, in Marseille, sort of stealing the limelight, and they can do whatever they can to put sticks in Marseille's spokes. And this will blow over. But of course, it doesn't. You know, Marseille are stripped of the league title that they won that season, 92-93. They are banned from defending the Champions League the following season and end up being relegated to France's second tier. And so there is this asterisk behind that Marseille triumph. And it's, you know, I go into it in a lot of detail in the book, but it's a difficult one to sort of, you know, take a firm position on, because clearly things happened at Marseille that shouldn't have happened. There was cheating. Players were paid off. There are all sorts of scurrilous accusations. But within the climate of the time, they weren't the only club who were doing that. And you speak to Marseille players from that team. I spoke to Papin, I spoke to Eric Dimeco, who's one of the figureheads, and they're quite unrepentant. You know, there's a sense of, oh, well, it's a shame that, you know, that we bought off Valenciennes. But we weren't the only ones doing it. And it's typical, you know, of France to want to sort of self-flagellate all the time. We should be able to celebrate this success.
But it does fall apart. Bernard Tapie ends up in prison. The team's broken up. But I tell you what, it's testament to the quality of this book and the number of stories that we barely mentioned PSG. And we probably should do, all things considered. Isn't it odd that they have spent infinite money over more than a decade and singly failed in a hugely amusing variety of ways to achieve their core objective of winning the Champions League? And the moment they turn their back on this doomed Galactico policy, I mean, yeah, we're talking a couple of months before the Champions League final. And yeah, by contract, athletic staff aren't allowed to make bets on football. But if I could, I'd be putting a bet on PSG right now. How has it taken them this long to figure out how to sort themselves out?
I think it's a fairly classic case of a club with too much money making decisions that aren't always motivated by purely sporting considerations. If you go back to the 2019-20 season, PSG get to the Champions League final and could very easily have won it. And obviously, you know, none of us have a particularly fond memories of that season and that final played at an empty Stadio de Luz in Lisbon. But very open game between PSG and Bayern Munich. PSG miss a lot of big chances. Bayern win it 1-0 with a goal from, of course, an ex-PSG youth team player, Kingsley Coman, who left PSG because he wasn't getting enough game time. The following season, PSG make it to the semi-finals. And I think there's a feeling at that point that PSG are kind of, they are close. They're exactly where they should be. And that's when the kind of Galacticos project goes into overdrive. And, you know, you can't blame PSG for signing Lionel Messi. Every single club in the world, if they thought they could have signed Lionel Messi, would have tried to. And obviously, you know, PSG ended up succeeding. And they bring in Sergio Ramos and they bring in Gianluigi Donnarumma and build this team of superstars. But they end up with this kind of hopelessly, you know, unbalanced starting 11. You've got a front three, Messi, Mbappe, Neymar, who don't do any defending. Midfield is overrun. And at the same time, there's this kind of fragility to PSG when it comes to the Champions League, and we've seen it season after season. I mean, the remontada in 2017 against Barcelona, the 6-1 at Camp Nou is the most notorious example, but, you know, losing to a Man United C team in 2019, even the way they collapsed against Real Madrid in 2022, there is some kind of fragility that has managed to knit its way into the fabric of the club. And I think that defeat, that elimination against Madrid in particular, was the elimination that caused the decision makers at PSG to realise this approach doesn't work. So we're going to rip it up. And that's where we are now in April 2024. There's one superstar in that PSG team, Kylian Mbappe, who is leaving at the end of the season. And it is a, you know, younger, hungrier, slightly more humble collection of footballers with an extremely accomplished coach in Luis Enrique, who's already won the Champions League. And one of the sort of complexities of writing the PSG chapter was deciding how to kind of leave it. because in the eyes of the wider world, the Qatari era at PSG is seen as, if not a failure, then something that hasn't yet achieved all its stated ambitions. But the moment PSG win the Champions League for the first time, which at some point you think they surely must, will be forced to look back at that in a completely different way. And it does feel, I mean, obviously, you know, semi-finalists, Borussia Dortmund to come, they could very soon be celebrating France's second European Cup.
They certainly seem a lot happier now than they were a year ago. And before we wrap up, one of the last chapters is about Toulouse, which has come under the ownership of Redbird. The Liverpool fans will know very well all about Toulouse. You mentioned that 9 French clubs at the start of this season in the top division are under US control or US influence. What are they seeing? What are they after?
I mean, there's obviously a lot of American investment right across European football. It's true in the Premier League, it's true in Serie A, it's true pretty much everywhere. But there are barriers to entry in the more high-profile European leagues because everything's so expensive. You know, if you want to buy a Premier League football team, you need an awful lot of money. If you want to buy one of the best French football teams, you also need a decent amount of money. But you can pick up the mid-ranking and lower-ranking teams relatively cheaply in terms of American hedge funds. So it's easier to get a stake in the French market, first of all. And also, there's an awful lot to recommend French football. You look at their world-leading youth development structures, the fact that a lot of French clubs are able to basically stay on an even keel financially purely by dint of the fact that they're able to produce, you know, future superstars at a very low cost and then sell them on for millions. So I think for American investors, it's a way of getting into European football without breaking the bank. And Toulouse is one example. There are Americans sort of everywhere you look in French football. Not all of them have been welcomed with open arms, no, which is, you know, which is no surprise.
We could do a whole different podcast on the ones that have gone wrong.
We could indeed, yeah.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we've got this. Vava Voom, Tom Williams, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Athletic.